I have associated Extinction Rebellion with fighting climate change. In fact, the group states that it wants to governments to declare a climate and ecological emergency. And so for a minute, when I learned about this event, there was a disconnect for me about the workshop they're hosting with you on Sunday. And then, like in a snap, it totally made sense to me. We're in a constant state of emergency. And it's related to climate change, which is completely connected to capitalism, which is completely connected to white supremacy. Can you talk a little bit about the event that you're going to be doing with Extinction Rebellion on Sunday?
Yes, I'm very happy to do that, Corinne. The way this came about, how you introduced this, that you were a little bit surprised to see that Extinction Rebellion was going to be sponsoring a webinar titled Understanding White Supremacy. The reason it happened is because of my intervention. That's why it's happening. I started going to XR meetings in the fall into the winter, up until, of course, the time that everything shut down because of the pandemic. The reason I started going is that a friend of mine has been very active with them. She had talked about the issue of, well, racism, I think would have been how it was described. She was talking about having dialogue with them about that. And she even did some trainings with them about racism. I know that the environmental movement in general has been very poor in general around issues having to do with race and class. That's been my observation. Although these are critical, crucial issues for everyone and for the planet, they don't seem to have really been that good over decades. And I'm not talking about XR. They haven't been that good around figuring out how to desegregate their organizing and to make it much more powerful and much more practical and useful if indeed they bring in the global majority that is most affected by these environmental devastations. So in any event, as I said, I was aware that there was some discussion about issues of race in our capital region, local XR. And I also knew that the kinds of discussions that they were having were really pretty much on the interpersonal level, which is how do we feel about racism and how do we change and how do we get to a better place around the fact that we're not living in an all-white world. That was all well and good to me, but that's not what I think of as the bottom line. The bottom line about white supremacy in the United States is not about how white people feel. It's about the fact that there's a system, and it's a system of power that really, really organizes virtually every single aspect of life. And that's what I want to talk to people in XR and elsewhere about.
Well, it couldn't come at a more critical moment in our time, right? I mean, I feel like I want to ask you to comment on this moment, but then I can't figure out exactly which moment I'm talking about. We've got the COVID-19 pandemic. We've got the police killings and the lynchings across the country, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd. And that's followed by decades of Sandra Bland, Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Patrick Dorisman, Amadou Diallo, like hundreds of names.
Thousands, actually. Thousands.
Right, thousands of names.
Yeah, because I'm going to put it in historical context. This is not new.
Right, it's not new at all. And then the election. And then yesterday's announcement, or I guess it was the day before, of Kamala Harris. And so it is a moment, you know, with a capital M. What can I ask you to say about this moment?
Well, I was just talking to a dear friend and colleague about that very thing, because I'm not sure that I understand all that I would like to understand about where we are. My questions to her, because we share political perspectives as Black feminists and Black women on the left, was what might come of what has been described as either a moment of inflection or a racial reckoning. And this is around the lynchings that you were describing. There are a lot of ways to look at what's going on at this time. A lot of it points back to, from my perspective, to white supremacy. I want to just make sure I don't forget to emphasize, it's not just the dozens of names that you mentioned that have happened within the last, let's say, 5 years or so. It's not just going back to, say, the 1980s or early 2000s or whatever. thousands and thousands of Black men, women, and children have been lynched since the end of the Civil War. And then there are, of course, other kinds of hate crimes and killings. Lynchings are often thought of classically, and this shows you what kind of country we're in when we can talk about a classic lynching. But a classic lynching is grabbing someone, often taking them out of jail where they are, generally falsely accused of a crime, and then hanging them. That's a classic lynching. But nowadays, our lynchings occur generally at the hands of the police. But there's a through line from that immediate post-war period, that is post-Civil War period, when the Klan arose, to today. What we have anti-Black racism in this nation and a history of racial violence that enforces a system of white supremacy.
You wrote a piece in the Boston Globe called "The Problem is White Supremacy," and my reading of it is that there is a difference between understanding that there are deep systems of oppression and then attributing that to white supremacy. And myself, having worked in the fields of criminal justice and public health and addressing disparities for several decades, there's such power in that. When you're addressing oppression, you're fighting for mitigation measures. And when you're understanding that it's about a system of power that keeps those systems of oppression in place, then you're in a different business altogether. For those who haven't yet read the piece, can you speak to that?
Well, you just did a beautiful job of summarizing the meaning of what it is I wrote about. I started writing it a few days after George Floyd was lynched. I did not know what else to do except to start writing. The reason I was so motivated to write is because I was so, and I'll just say very clearly, infuriated by the way that the people who get to be the talking heads were talking about what had just occurred and what it meant, because they put it, as usual, into these buckets of partial understandings. Race relations, people not being nice to each other, needing to train the police, all kinds of things that are partial solutions when you get right down to it, but never looking at the first cause. And the first cause is a system of white supremacy that has been in place ever since probably first contact. I mean, the system probably started to grow and build from the moment that the white people from Europe in their ships came and invaded a nation that was inhabited and said they had discovered a nation that was inhabited. And that's a long time. That's more than 500 years of white supremacy. This is not new for me, that is having this kind of analysis. I mean, it did not take the slaughter of George Floyd for me to start thinking about white supremacy. The description of what I'm doing with XR, with Extinction Rebellion, I wrote that description before George Floyd was actually murdered. So, it's, as I said, this is not new. I just wanted to get it out. I wanted to get it on paper, and I wanted to get it in front of the eyes of people who get to make the decisions, who get to do all the talking about this, and then get to make the decisions. And that would be people in a political office, and that would also be people who shape the cultural, social, and media discussion around these issues. It's been a frustrating effort. Most people in the United States, when they talk about race and racism, they are talking about race relations. How do people of different groups feel about each other, treat each other, and get along with each other or not get along? That's where it stays. And as long as you do that, you're not really going to get to the bottom line.
You've been at this for a long time, all your life, really. I think it's important for folks to know that you were, as a high school student, leading all desegregation protests in 1964. You were involved with CORE and Students for a Democratic Society, and then you went on to become a leader in the Black feminist political scene. I remember reading your essays when I was a grad student in 1990, and I was already a decade late to the party. Are you tired?
Well, are you asking me, am I tired today? Are you asking? Like I say, yeah, I'm tired today. But that's, you know, that's just goes with the territory of being a human being and trying to live through this pandemic in the best and most reasonable and safe ways. So there's that. But if you're asking if I'm tired of fighting for freedom, no, I'm not tired of that. Not at all. The only thing that makes it viable for me to be a person who is multiply oppressed, who has multiply oppressed social political identities in the United States is to be fighting for freedom. That's the only thing that works. Otherwise, I've always said that if you don't fight for freedom and liberation, it's like saying to Massa, Massa, that's fine. You just keep that big, heavy foot, that booted foot on my neck. And isn't it ironic that that's a metaphor I have used for decades about what it means not to fight for freedom, because that's pretty much what that officer, that police officer, did to George Floyd. He buried his knee. He put his knee right on his neck until he choked the life out of him. And as I said, for many, many decades, I've said the reason that I am an organizer and an activist is because I don't want that foot on my neck. So no, I'm not tired. There's a song, which is a gospel song. I'm not big into gospel. I'm very secular, like jazz. Jazz is my jam, but you know, nobody knows about jazz anymore. Be happy. Let's do another show about that. But this is not a freedom song, and it's definitely not jazz. It's a church song, and the line is, the title is, I ain't no ways tired. Mm-hmm. I ain't no ways tired. And that's a good answer to am I tired fighting for freedom. You mentioned CORE, and this is just a footnote for people who don't know. CORE is the Congress of Racial Equality. And I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and CORE was a national organization. In fact, I found out supporting Bernie Sanders' campaign and being a national surrogate for his campaign in 2020, also supported him in 2016, I found out that he was in CORE when he was at the University of Chicago. So I just love the fact, because we're about the same age. He's a few years older. And I love the fact that we are part of the same civil rights organization. CORE was also, as I've discovered in my research reading, I discovered that it was the most left of the mainstream civil rights organizations, except, of course, for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Mm. You've been in good company for a very long time.
I've done my best, Corinne.
Barbara, what gives you hope at this moment?
The fact that people are still involved in struggle. What gives me hope is that people all over the world who would look at our lives here and say, boy, you people are so lucky. You are so fortunate. You know, you're not living in cardboard slums. You know, we have a huge homeless problem, but it doesn't compare to what you see in the so-called developing world. Our situation doesn't compare, and what is going on in war-torn countries, that the U.S. usually is on the wrong side of any of that. You know, Syria, Yemen, Palestine, all of these places where people are in struggle, that's what gives me hope, because I'm not a part of just a movement in this local region or in our nation. It's a global movement. People, I think, inherently resist oppression, because that's not the state that we should live in. That's not a natural state for humans. And it's not a natural state probably for our other, you know, our other live beings either. But we resist. Yeah, we resist being imprisoned, being boxed in, being stereotyped and subjugated. We resist not being seen. As long as people are in struggle, and we saw such phenomenal struggle in the wake of George Floyd's lynching. The fact that it was all 50 states, it was global, people all over the world, and in every single state in the United States, some of which barely have any black people in them or other kinds of people of color. Every single place, people were out saying Black Lives Matter. But what do we do with that? That's my question. That's what I was talking to my colleague and friend about. What do we do with that energy? We don't have a strong left in this nation. We do not have a strong left, a strong organized left. So when we have these great moments of opportunity, we often squander them because we don't have a mechanism like a very, very vital third party, for example. We don't have ways of mobilizing those instincts and those commitments to make change.
I'm feeling very hopeful about the younger generation. My niece has been out there on the streets, and that's what's giving me hope. And I hope that they become leaders like you have been your entire life. Barbara, who needs to attend the event on Sunday?
Well, I would say the immediate world. but the Zoom platform is not going to accommodate that. That is such a question. Who needs to attend? there are people, I guess, who have a really good grasp of what is going on here around race and racism. I would count them in the thousands, probably. And I'm talking about the entire country now. There are thousands of people in a country of over 300 million that have a grasp. The rest of y'all,
the rest of y'all could probably benefit.
And even people who have really good perspectives about race in this nation don't necessarily have an analysis of the kind that I hope to share with those who participate, because this nation, this country, does everything possible to hide and to keep the information about what's really going on away from people. Our nation does not teach history. As I heard someone say recently, our nation teaches nostalgia. Mm. Not history, but nostalgia. Mm-hmm. There are only two states in the entire country where the term white supremacy is in the state standards for the teaching of history. Mm. So you have 48 states with standards for teaching U.S. history, and those 48 states do not mention white supremacy. Only two states do. So what are you going to learn? What will you learn? You will learn about prejudice. You'll find out that the Civil War was a states' rights issue, that it wasn't fought to abolish slavery. You'll find out a lot of stuff that's just not true, even if you know you have a good grasp and have been studying, because you have to study. You can't just get your information out of social media about what's woke and what does all this mean. That will not work. You actually have to read something. Those things, to my mind, are called books, but you can start with articles too. Even people who are very well grounded in this information just might want to hear this old head talk about her perspective on it. So everybody's invited.
Barbara, thank you so much. It's such an important event on Sunday, and I hope our listeners will tune in. Thank you for talking to me.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.